Chapter 14. Bin Laden's Legacy. President George W. Bush delivered a keynote speech about the war on terrorism on October 6, 2005, at the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C. In that speech, the president mentioned bin Laden by name several times, something the president rarely does. An excerpt follows. The murderous ideology of the Islamic radicals is the great challenge of our new century. Yet in many ways, this fight resembles the struggle against communism in the last century. Like the ideology of communism, Islamic radicalism is elitist, led by a self-appointed vanguard that presumes to speak for the Muslim masses. Bin Laden says his own role is to tell Muslims, quote, what is good for them and what is not. And what this man who grew up in wealth and privilege considers good for poor Muslims is that they become killers and suicide bombers. He assures them that this is the road to paradise, though he never offers to go along for the ride. Like the ideology of communism, our new enemy teaches that innocent individuals can be sacrificed to serve a political vision, and this explains their cold-blooded contempt for human life. It may take years, but eventually bin Laden will be captured or killed. So what are the implications of either of those outcomes? If bin Laden is captured alive, where, for instance, should he be put on trial? As his crimes have spanned many countries, a case could be made that he should be tried by a specially convened international tribunal. The treatment meted out to Saddam Hussein after his capture in Iraq in December 2003 provides a useful template for the capture of bin Laden should he be taken alive. The pictures beamed around the world of Saddam submitting himself to a doctor's search for head lice did more to puncture the Iraqi dictator's mystique than anything else. Similar pictures would do much to deflate bin Laden's mythic persona. Of course, capturing bin Laden alive is unlikely. On several occasions, bin Laden has said that he's prepared to die in his holy war, statements that should be taken at face value. In the short term, bin Laden's death would likely trigger violent anti-American attacks around the globe, while in the medium term, his death would be a serious blow to al-Qaeda, the formal organization, as bin Laden's charisma and organizational skills have played a critical role in its success. However, bin Laden does have 11 sons, some of whom might choose to take a role in their father's organization. Already, Saad bin Laden, who is in his mid-20s, has played a significant role in al-Qaeda. In the longer term, bin Laden's martyrdom would likely give a boost to the power of his ideas. Sayyid Qutb was a relatively obscure writer before his execution by the Egyptian government in 1966. After his death, Qutb's writings, which called for offensive holy wars against the enemies of Islam, became enormously influential. The same process will likely happen with the death of bin Laden, but to a much larger degree, as bin Laden's prestige and fame far eclipse Qutb's. And so, in death, bin Laden's ideas will likely attain a measure of lasting currency. Following are excerpts from bin Laden's will, written on December 14, 2001, and which appeared October 2002 in Al-Majalla magazine. Allah bears witness that the love of jihad and death in the cause of Allah has dominated my life, and the verses of the sword permeated every cell in my heart. And fight the pagans all together as they fight you all together. How many times did I wake up to find myself reciting this holy verse? O women, kinfolk, do not ever use cosmetics or imitate the whores and mannish women of the West. O my wives, you were, after Allah, the best support and the best help. From the first day you knew that the road was full of thorns and mines. You left the comforts of your relatives and chose to share the hardships next to me. As to my children, forgive me because I have given you only a little of my time since I answered the jihad call. I have chosen a road fraught with dangers, and for this sake suffered from hardships, embitterment, betrayal, and treachery. I advise you not to work with Al-Qaeda and the Front, the Islamic Front for fighting the Crusaders and the Jews. Jamal Khalifa, bin Laden's brother-in-law. Omar, the son of Osama, aged maybe 24, 25, was in Afghanistan for 9/11. Before 9/11, his father was telling him that something big was going to happen, very big. Then he came here to Saudi Arabia. He was really angry with his father. He was angry with the situation. He said, "What are they thinking when they destroy these two towers?" He said it was really silly thinking. Now Omar is trying to educate himself and work because Osama did not educate his children. He did not send them to schools. He wanted to educate them by the very old traditional way, to let them memorize the Quran, and after that the Hadith, sayings of the Prophet, and poetry. So Omar, he was really feeling sorry. He saw the difference between himself and the others in the family. They are all graduated from college. Hutaifa Azam, the son of Abdullah Azam. Bin Laden's sons, Abdullah and Omar, are in Saudi Arabia. Abdurrahman is in Syria with his mother, bin Laden's first wife, in Damascus, and the rest are in Afghanistan. Omar came back after the war in Afghanistan. He is against his father. I met him 2 years after 9/11, and we spent 4 days together in Hajj, pilgrimage in Mecca, in the same tent together. I told him, "What do you think about September 11th? He said, "It's craziness." He said that those guys are dummies. They have destroyed everything and for nothing. What did we get from September 11th? He said, "It's just because of those crazy Egyptians." And he was abusing his father. Abdul Bari Atwan, who interviewed bin Laden in 1996. There will be different interpretations and evaluations of Osama bin Laden. Some people will consider him a heroic phenomenon, a mighty little David who challenged the might of Goliath, who is the Americans. Other people will say he was disastrous. 11 September managed to actually drag the Americans into the region and occupy Iraq. I believe Osama bin Laden is the one who actually opened the American eyes to their mistake to support rotten, corrupt dictatorships in the Arab world. Before, they were happy to deal with these rotten dictatorships. They were happy to keep the region as it is. But after 11 September, the Americans awakened to the fact that they are siding with these regimes which create a huge frustration and radicalism and are actually fueling Islamic fundamentalism against the West. Abu Jandal, formerly bin Laden's chief bodyguard. Al-Qaeda became an ideology. What affected this transformation from an armed group into an ideology is the United States. All Muslims around the world came to view the source of their tragedy as one, namely the United States. It was the source of all their problems, interfering in all internal Muslim affairs from the Far East to the Far West. They became convinced that the only effective way to stop the United States interference is the Qaeda way, that is, by direct attacks and armed confrontations. Now, every element of Al-Qaeda is self-activated. Whoever finds a chance to attack just goes ahead. The decision is theirs. This is regardless of whether they pledged allegiance to Sheikh Osama bin Laden or not. In the case of his death, I think he will be a symbol for all those who follow him, especially in the case of his assassination. He will be an idol for all those who believe in his ideas. He will be a great inspiration for them to follow in his footsteps. His death will be a great force for stirring up everybody's emotions and enthusiasm to follow him on the path of martyrdom. In case of his arrest, the situation might be a bit different. It might lead to a strong psychological defeat for the group's members and many Muslims. Khalid Khawaja is the former Pakistani Air Force officer who fought with bin Laden in Afghanistan in 1987. He will never be captured. He's not Saddam Hussein. He's Osama. Osama loves death. Bin Laden has played his role. Osama has woken up the sleeping bin Ladens. Jamal Ismail, a Palestinian journalist based in Pakistan, first met bin Laden in 1984 and has encountered him many times since. If bin Laden is killed, there is no charismatic personality to replace him. Ayman al-Zawahiri is an intellectual, not a leader, and his leadership is anyway challenged by other Egyptians. No one can challenge bin Laden's leadership. The death of bin Laden will be 1,000 times bigger for the jihadist movement than the death in 1966 of the Egyptian jihadist ideologue Said Qutb, because of the new information technology. Muntasir al-Zayat, the Egyptian lawyer who first met Ayman al-Zawahiri while they were both jailed following the assassination of President Anwar Sadat of Egypt in 1981. In 2002, al-Zayat wrote The Road to Al-Qaeda, a critical biography of Zawahiri, excerpts of which follow. The point of disagreement among Islamists, and especially between Zawahiri and me, is how best to deal with the world's superpower. Bin Laden's desire to take revenge, heedless of the American and international response, and its effect on the future of the Islamic movements in the world, has given the Americans and other governments the power to destroy the Islamists before our eyes. Not all Islamists in Afghanistan are connected to Al-Qaeda or bin Laden, and some even disagreed with the man and the ideas of his group. Bin Laden and Zawahiri's behavior was met with a lot of criticism from many Islamists in Egypt and abroad. Some of them contacted me and were very critical of the consequences of the 9/11 attacks and the lack of clarity as to whether they, Al-Qaeda's leaders, were behind them or not. A lot of Islamists, including the Hawks as well as those supporting the use of peaceful means, opposed Zawahiri's attempts to link Egyptian Islamists to bin Laden. The hawkish Islamists thought that the American war on Afghanistan shattered any hope that Islamists living outside of Egypt would return to resume their struggle against the Egyptian government. In the post-September 11 world, no countries can afford to be accused of harboring the enemies of the United States. Rahimullah Yousafzai, one of Pakistan's leading journalists, interviewed bin Laden twice in the late 1990s. An excerpt follows. I think that Mr. bin Laden sees himself as a man who would sacrifice his life for his beliefs. He would like to go down fighting. He would like to become a martyr. He won't surrender. I think that he would not allow himself to be captured and to be produced in some court in New York, and that is why I have this belief that he will fight until the end. I believe that he will be a much more popular man for many Muslims once he becomes a martyr, because Mr. bin Laden, as a dead man, would be even more potent than when he is alive. Abu Musab al-Suri, long an associate of bin Laden's, released his book, The International Islamic Resistance Call, in December 2004. By implication, al-Suri here makes clear that the jihadist movement has been severely damaged by the 9/11 attacks. The status of the Islamic people has changed after the incidents of 9/11. We are in a stage where the American and Europeans and their friends, the Jews, have taken the lead role. Some important matters resulting from September 11th, which have negatively affected the Muslims. America destroyed the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, which became the refuge for the Mujahideen. They killed hundreds of Mujahideen who defended the Emirate. Then America captured more than 600 jihadists from different Arab countries and Pakistan and jailed them. The jihad movement rose to glory in the 1960s and continued through the 70s and 80s and resulted in the rise of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, but was destroyed after 9/11. The reign of Clinton ended with the election of Bush, son of the first Bush who began the Crusader War against the Muslims under his reign. This brought the rise of the extremist Christians and the movement known as the neocons. They began shamelessly promoting their ideas, beliefs, and plans. And they announced that America is the inheritor of the Roman Empire and is going to take its place in history and the future. And America took justification from its war on terror to wipe out the Islamic reawakening. Saad al-Faqi, formerly a surgeon in Saudi Arabia, runs a Saudi opposition group based in London. I think that Al-Qaeda's influence is immense now in the Muslim and Arab world. What the U.S. leaders have done after the 9/11 attacks is actually to implement what bin Laden wanted. That is, to wage a cosmic campaign against Muslims. Numan bin Utman, the Libyan who fought with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in the early 90s. 9/11 destroyed 95% of the existing organization. The United States of America is involved directly in this war. The organization doesn't exist anymore. I think bin Laden now is driven by his tactics, not strategy. The tactics have taken over the strategy. It's always about just kill, shoot, destroy, bomb in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Now it's in America, in Europe. You can't talk to these people. It's killing, shooting, sacrificing. My point of view is bin Laden himself and his group will achieve nothing. They will fail to achieve what they are asking for. And bin Laden, his credibility, it's decreasing, not increasing. What has been increasing is this kind of new tactic, the suicide attacks. In the 70s and 80s, and even the 90s, all these jihadi groups, they failed to overthrow the governments. I told them myself that. I told Zawahiri, we failed. All the jihadi movements failed because we cannot recruit the people. It's as simple as that. That is the rules of the war, especially guerrilla warfare. I think the godfather for all these things is Mao Zedong. That's the theory. It's very complete. It's Mao. We failed to recruit the people. Zawahiri, in his autobiographical Nights Under the Prophet's Banner, published in December 2001, recognizes that Al-Qaeda has not engaged the affection of the masses. The jihad movement must come closer to the masses. We must win the people's confidence, respect, and affection. The people will not love us unless they felt that we love them, care about them, and are ready to defend them. The Muslim nation will not participate unless the slogans of the Mujahideen are understood by the masses of the Muslim nation. The one slogan that has been well understood by the Muslim nation, and to which it has been responding for the past 50 years, is the call for the jihad against Israel. The fact that must be acknowledged is that the issue of Palestine is the cause that has been firing up the feelings of the Muslim nation from Morocco to Indonesia for the past 50 years. In addition, it is a rallying point for all the Arabs, be they believers or non-believers. In addition to this slogan, the Muslim nation has responded favorably to the call for the jihad against the Americans. It is a battle of ideologies, a struggle for survival, and a war with no truce. More importantly, this is a goal that could take several generations to achieve. The Crusaders in Palestine and Syria left after 2 centuries of continued jihad in the Middle Ages. The French occupied Algeria for more than a century before they departed in 1962. In the United States, bin Laden is commonly seen as an avatar of Islamofascism, or simply as an evil criminal. Of course, while bin Laden is indeed the intellectual author of many crimes, he is a more complex figure than these caricatures would suggest. In my view, bin Laden is an intelligent political actor who is fighting a deeply felt religious war against the West. Bin Laden, like others before him, has adopted terrorism as a rational choice to bring certain political goals nearer, and as a shortcut to transforming the political landscape. After World War II, Israel's future Prime Minister Menachem Begin and his Irgun organization, for instance, conducted a campaign of terror against British targets in Palestine to hasten the British withdrawal from the country, a strategy that proved successful. Bin Laden's organization has killed thousands, while Irgun's victims numbered only in the scores. But the use of terrorism is motivated by the same strategic choice. It is a weapon the weak use against the strong. Bin Laden hopes that ultimately his campaign of terror against the United States will achieve his long-time goal of destabilizing and bringing down the House of Saud. Underlying bin Laden's political goals are his understanding of religion. As the interviews in this book make clear, from his earliest years, bin Laden was a religious zealot, someone whose religiosity stood out even as a teenager in the conservative milieu of Saudi Arabia in the 1970s. Bin Laden's experiences fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan gave him the confidence of his religious convictions. In his view, a superpower had been defeated by lightly armed Muslims motivated only by faith. That experience also turned him into a leader, sure of his own ability to lead men into battle. Bin Laden harnessed his religious convictions to a political program that has some revolutionary features: the overthrow of the House of Saud, and some anti-colonial features, ending Western, particularly American, influence in the Arabian Peninsula, and eventually from the entire Middle East, and then the larger Muslim world. In past years, Al-Qaeda, the organization, has evolved into an ideology of Bin Ladenism, an ideology that can be summarized as fervent opposition to Western foreign policies in the Middle East and the desire for regime change and the rule of Sharia, Islamic law, across the Muslim world. This ideology has reached a vast global audience as a result of the wide dissemination of Bin Laden's multiple statements since the 9/11 attacks. Also, the Internet has created a multiplier effect for Al-Qaeda's ideas. Now it is no longer necessary to go to Afghanistan to sit at the feet of Al-Qaeda's leaders or to obtain explosives training. Signing up for the jihad is a mouse click away. Bin Ladenism will never enjoy the mass appeal of other destructive ideologies of the modern era, such as communism, but it certainly enjoys wider support today than the secular Arab socialism that gripped much of the Middle East in past decades. And this means that we have barely begun the war with Al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups, because many thousands of underemployed, disaffected men in the Muslim world will continue to embrace Bin Laden's doctrine of violent anti-Westernism. I write this more than 4 years after the 9/11 attacks, and an obvious question looking back over those years is, how successful has Bin Laden's project been to remake the Muslim world? So far, it has been something of a bust. American armies now occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. While U.S. forces have been drawn down significantly in Saudi Arabia, they remain in great force in other parts of the Arabian Peninsula, such as Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait. The marriage of convenience between Saudi Arabia and the United States took a hit after 9/11 and the news that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudi. But now, as oil prices soar and the Saudi government engages in its own belated battle with extremists, that alliance seems as robust as ever. And most governments around the Muslim world are falling over themselves to cooperate with the United States in the war on terrorism. And so, could 9/11, in fact, be the last gasp of the radical Islamists? In 1992, the French academic Olivier Roy wrote an important book, The Failure of Political Islam, in which he proposed that political Islam had reached its high water mark with the Khomeini Revolution in Iran in 1979 and had been in decline since. Another leading French academic, Gilles Kepel, amplified that thesis a year before 9/11 in Jihad, Expansion et Déclin de l'Islamisme, which made the inarguable point that Islamist states such as Sudan and Taliban-controlled Afghanistan had turned out to be abject failures. Following 9/11, Kepel published his book in English as Jihad, The Trail of Political Islam, in which he argued, in spite of what many hasty commentators contended in its immediate aftermath, the attack on the United States was a desperate symbol of the isolation, fragmentation, and decline of the Islamist movement, not a sign of its strength. Surprisingly, explicit or implicit support for that view comes from a range of Islamist militants and jihadists we have heard from in this book, who decry 9/11 for a variety of reasons. The attacks had no Islamic justification, they destroyed the Taliban, and they woke up the sleeping American giant, which has gone on a campaign against Islamist militants around the Muslim world, including in places such as Chechnya and Kashmir, areas of conflict that the U.S. government had previously tended to view as legitimate nationalist struggles. As we have learned to our cost in recent years, much secret information is simply wrong, while information that is public For instance, bin Laden's repeated calls for attacks against the United States in the years before 2001 is too often discounted. One of the lessons of September 11th is that we should pay careful attention to what the jihadists are actually saying. And what they are saying about September 11th is that the attacks may have been a tactical victory, but they were a strategic disaster because of the loss of Afghanistan as a base, and the U.S.-led campaign to detain members of jihadist movements around the world. That's why Islamist militants are happy that the Bush administration ordered the invasion of Iraq. Without the Iraq War, their movement under assault externally and fragmented internally would have imploded a year or so after September 11th. For the moment, bin Laden is buoyed up by American reverses in Iraq and the fact that the key insurgent leader in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, has acknowledged al-Qaeda's primacy at the head of the jihadist movement. But bin Laden's larger project, inciting a clash of civilizations between the West and the Muslim world, which he believes the forces of Islam will inevitably win in the long term, has been a failure. Zawahiri complained in his 2001 biography, Knights Under the Prophet's Banner, that the masses have not embraced al-Qaeda. This is despite the fact that bin Laden enjoys a large degree of personal popularity in the Muslim world for his stance against the United States. In a passage quoted in this chapter, Zawahiri explains, "The jihad movement must come closer to the masses. We must win the people's confidence, respect, and affection." But that is not going to be possible when the average Muslim knows that killing civilians is explicitly prohibited by the Quran and al-Qaeda presents no positive vision of the world it wants to create other than vague references to restoring the caliphate. Al-Qaeda is against a lot of things. U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, Israel, India's role in Kashmir, and Russia's war in Chechnya, to name a few. But it has articulated no vision of the world it aims to create. Taliban-controlled Afghanistan is the type of utopian society that al-Qaeda seems to want to impose on the rest of the Islamic world. This is not a winning vision of the future for the vast majority of Muslims around the globe. Meanwhile, bin Laden and other leaders of al-Qaeda seemed to have painted themselves into a corner where their only strategy is to call for more violence. As the Libyan jihadist Noman bin Othman perceptively observes in this chapter, this is an example of tactics taking over strategy. And if I were to write an epitaph for Osama bin Laden, it would be that he was a man whose violent tactics became his only strategy. Osama bin Laden, from the will that he wrote in December 2001. Praise be to Allah, and peace be upon the Master of the Messengers, his family, and his companions. We ask for his forgiveness, seek his guidance, and seek refuge from him for our sins and evil actions. We pray to Allah, praise and glory be to him, to accept us with the martyrs and the virtuous ones among his worshippers, and to make us die Muslims.